Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Tuesday, October 9th. I'm Ray Graff. Today we are going to discuss climate change and the energy sector. Some of the world's top climate scientists recently concluded that global warming is likely to reach dangerous levels unless new technologies are developed to remove greenhouse gases from the atmosphere. In the studio for the discussion and to answer your questions are Matthias Vee and Lou Alstadt. Matthias is a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Environmental Sciences at the University at Albany, who specializes in climate change. I'll be screwing up his last name for the entire program. Lou Alstadt is a former Mobil Oil executive who closely follows renewable energy. If you have a question, now's the time to call 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551, and we get started right after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today we'll discuss climate change and the energy sector. Some of the world's top climate scientists recently concluded that global warming likely to reach dangerous levels unless new technologies are developed to remove greenhouse gases from the atmosphere. The UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change says pledges from the world's governments to reduce greenhouse gases made in Paris in 2015 are not enough to keep global warming from rising more than 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit above pre-industrial temperatures. Joining us for this discussion today, Matthias Vee and Lou Alstadt. Matthias is a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Environmental Sciences at the University at Albany. His research focuses on past, present, and future climate change impacts in the tropics and on glacier mass balance and water resources. He has participated in more than a dozen field trips to the Andes and Kilimanjaro. Lou Alstadt is a former Mobil Oil executive who now focuses on renewable energy. He was an executive vice president of Mobil and operating officer for exploration and producing in the U.S., Canada, and Latin America. He oversaw Mobil's oil and gas drilling, both onshore and offshore, in the Western Hemisphere. Our number to call is 800-348-2551 if you have a question, 800-348-2551. You can also email the program at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, our number is 800-348-2551. Matthias and Lou, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it was 728 pages long. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report would appear to be, I'm no expert, a little gloomy.
That's right.
And you guys read the whole thing?
Haven't read the whole thing, but I've read the summary, which is fairly extensive. And my initial reaction is that it is not telling us a whole lot that anybody that's been following climate change didn't already know.
Matthias?
Yeah, I tend to agree, but I think it puts the spotlight on the challenge that we are facing going forward if we really want to limit the amount of warming on a global scale to 1.5 degrees Celsius or 2 degrees Celsius. That's not going to happen by itself, and it requires a massive transformation on a global scale how we produce.
Now, why energy. Is that number important, 1.8 degrees or 2 degrees? Why is that the key here?
So, I mean, the exact number by itself really is kind of meaningless. Whether it's 1.9 degrees Celsius or 2.1 degrees Celsius does not make that much of a difference. But there are a number of changes in our environment, ecosystems, ice sheets, that we think if we go beyond 2 degrees might become unstable and that we might lock into irreversible changes on our planet that we cannot reverse in the long term. So, such as the melting of the Greenland ice sheet, for example.
Mm-hmm. How long has it been since there has been an ice sheet in Greenland? Do we have any idea?
Yeah, it's been around for a long time. We don't have very long ice core records from Greenland. The ones that we have go back to the last, what we call interglacial, so about 120,000 years. Mm-hmm. At that point, the ice sheet was a bit smaller, but it was still there.
Mm-hmm. Our guests today are Lou Alstadt and Matthias Vee, and we welcome your calls at 800-348-2551. This report suggests something perhaps a little more radical, and that's take that goal from Paris and basically double it or cut in half the amount of, go to 0.9 degrees Fahrenheit for an increase. We'll limit it there. That would seem to be a rather That would be a difficult thing to do practically in 20 or 30 years, right?
Yes, yeah. It would be very difficult to do that. But every time we just sit around and say it's going to be difficult to do and don't start moving, we lose ground. So we have to get started. Looking for the absolute best solution of things like that is not viable in the long term if we don't get moving.
So, Matthias, where do we start?
Well, we have to start on many different levels. We have to start on a technological level. We have to invest in research and development. We have to invest in education, that people are really become aware of this problem. We have to start on a political level, and we have to start on an engineering level. So, and all of these things have to happen on the local scale, the state scale, the national and the international scale. It's an international problem. It's not something we can solve alone, even if we wanted to.
Do you think that the climate is now at the point of no return?
No, I wouldn't say that the climate is in a point of no return, but there's certain components of the climate system that are more vulnerable than others. I'll give you an example, sea ice in the Arctic, for example. We are already very far down the road where we can say with almost high degree of certainty that during the summer months in the future, we will have no sea ice in the Arctic. We already know that we have committed to a certain amount of sea level rise that will continue to occur in the future, even if we would stop burning fossil fuel tomorrow. Hmm. So there are some built-in commitments that we have already sort of agreed to, if you want to put it that way, that we cannot stop, at least not in the short run.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. Matthias V. and Lou Ahlstadt are here to answer your questions on climate change. And let's go to the phones. We go over to, boy, the lines are loading up fast. Nancy in Schenectady. Nancy, you're on.
Hi. I'm concerned about all the cuts being done to the EPA, the Environmental Protective Agency, whatever. Anyway, one of the cuts is to reduce the Clean Power Plan, which Obama had gotten in, started with. And right now I think that there's a public comment period going on, and I think it ends fairly soon. I'd like to know if there's any. The other thing I'm wondering is, making comments to this agency, is it effective to make arguments from a, you know, I'm a faith-based kind of person, if it's effective to make comments from the moral point of view, or if I really need to quote a lot of scientific facts, or if they've got the, I don't know, they don't act like they've got the scientific facts they need anyway. That's my big concern right now. And if it's effective for people to be commenting during this comment period, I think the more people that comment, the better. I don't know if the guests on the program have any particular information on that.
I think Lou wants to weigh in here.
Okay, I think there are a couple points here. Number one, by all means, comment and do it from what you know. If you don't know the science, don't try to talk about the science. Talk about what you do know. Secondly, I think it's important to recognize that in spite of some of the setbacks that you see in governmental activities at the national level, that an awful lot is going on in the right direction elsewhere and isn't really being slowed down very much by national politics. Companies throughout the U.S. and around the world are paying a lot more attention to greenhouse gas emissions and actually having plans to deal with it and things like that. So I would not be totally discouraged. I'm somewhat discouraged by some of the actions by the EPA, but I would not be totally discouraged because I don't think they're completely effective.
If I could just add, I think it's totally okay also to really argue from based on whatever background you come from. Because climate change, of course, it's a scientific issue, but I would argue it's also a moral and an ethical issue as to what world we want to leave behind for future generations, because that's what's happening right now. We are taxing our children and grandchildren.
Our number is 800-348-2551. We go over to Yuli and Lee. You're on.
Yes, hi. Thank you. I wanted to first of all say how much I appreciate that you're having this topic on Vox Pop. I think we could have it every week if so important. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
I also wanted to briefly make a comment and say I encourage your listeners to check out the Bipartisan Climate Solutions Caucus in Congress. Nobody hardly knows about it, but it's a very interesting group of Republicans and Democrats working together. And the other thing I wanted to ask was has to do with methane. Do you think that the rise in gas production recently is responsible for some of the accelerated warming that we're seeing now, that warming that wasn't actually really anticipated by climate scientists? Is that why suddenly the heating curve is getting so much steeper? Could that be a reason?
Lou.
It certainly contributes to it, but it takes a while for this to build up. So it's not something that just happened recently.
Matthias.
The recent more rapid rise in temperatures has other reasons as well. Global warming isn't sort of a steady increase in temperature that every year it gets warmer by the same amount. There's a lot of, we call this noise, but it's really climate variability built in. On top of that, a lot of it has to do with how the global ocean take up heat and release it. And we've had a strong El Nino event in 2015, 2016, where a lot of heat was released back into the atmosphere that the oceans previously had taken up.
Why did that happen?
So most of the extra energy that our planet receives from global warming actually is stored in the ocean. Most of it is not even used to warm up our planet directly. It gets stored in the ocean, and then over time it gets released. And that happens every few years.
But what triggered the event?
The El Nino event?
Yeah.
Okay, now it gets a little more complicated.
All right, well, we're going to take a break here in a moment, but you have 20 seconds, and then I think Lou wanted to follow up.
Okay. So El Nino events, basically what they are is the ocean and the atmosphere, they talk to each other, they interact with one another, and they do this on different timescales, and that leads to the ocean basically being quiet for a while, taking up all the energy, and then at some point the ocean says, it's enough, I got to release all this heat now, and that's when we have an El Nino event.
All right, Lou, before we hit the break, go ahead.
Just a couple additions. One is that most people don't realize that methane gas is a far more potent greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. Over a short period, say 20 years, it's something like 80 times more potent. Over 100 years, maybe 20 to 30 times more potent. So it's an important thing to stop. The other thing that most people don't realize is that when you produce oil, you also get gas. So it's not just natural gas production that causes methane issues. It comes along with oil as well.
We are joined today by Lou Alstadt and Matthias Vuy, and we'll take a break here. 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. We'll be back on Vox Pop. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. Matthias Vuy and Lou Alstadt joining us today on to talk about climate change. And gentlemen, we'll take care of a couple of emails here before we get back to the phones. This one came in from Anne in Albany. Question for Lou. Many environmentalists believe that taxing fossil fuel companies for their carbon emissions is the best way to reduce greenhouse emissions. Do you agree? If so, what is the best way to create carbon tax legislation?
Okay. The last part's hard because it's a complicated subject. First of all, I definitely agree that putting some kind of a cost on carbon is needed to help us move more quickly.
Yeah.
If your goal is to move quickly, you've got to put a price on the things that you want to discourage. So how do you do it? The best way that I have heard, and I've looked at a lot of different systems, is one put out by Citizens Climate Lobby and also a few other groups, where you would put a fee on the carbon content of fuels and refund that fee somehow to all households throughout the country so that people would see the price of a higher price of the car of the fuels that they buy and could then decide whether they want to put the money that they're getting back toward a more efficient car, toward changing their heating system, towards putting some solar panels on the roofs, things like that.
Okay. This one is from Philomena in Post and Kill. Would you please address how climate change is impacting and threatening agriculture?
That's a good question. It depends a little bit where you are, in what part of the world. The biggest threat for agriculture is not here in the Northeast. The largest changes or the biggest threats we expect to see in tropical regions that are already very hot today. There's a number of crops that have upper limits on their heat tolerance that will not reproduce or not grow when it gets too hot. Wheat is one such example. So we think the biggest problem for food production on a global scale will be in tropical countries. But there's certainly also threats in the U.S. We see this today already during periods of extreme drought, for example. So increased drought and increased heat puts a large stress on many crops, including soybeans and corns, etc.
All right. This one is from David, and he writes, given the deadline of approximately 12 years recently announced for humans to change the behaviors that adversely affect the climate of planet Earth, what are the most practical things that average citizens should do in light of this warning, and should not voting for political leaders who will take appropriate measures be at the top of the list? And that's from David.
Yeah, I think looking at your political leaders and getting them to put climate change and actions to address it on the top of their lists is very important, and voting is the way to get their attention.
All right, this one is the last email we'll do, and then we'll get back to the phones. A lot of people have been waiting a long time. This one's from Samuel in Cooperstown. Could what seems to be an increase in massive earthquakes, often on the ocean floor, with resulting tsunamis, be caused by the worldwide increase of heat on the surface of the Earth?
The question is a resounding no. We actually know where this extra heat comes from. We can measure the extra energy at the top of our atmosphere. So it's coming from above through the greenhouse gases. We can measure the energy that goes into the planet Earth system, and we can measure the energy that's going out, and it's an imbalance, and it's caused by greenhouse gases.
No, I think Samuel's question was, could the earthquakes be caused by the heat, the increase of heat on the surface of the Earth?
No, earthquakes are caused by plate tectonics, plates that are subducting below one another, plates that are rubbing against one another. It has nothing to do with the increase in greenhouse gases.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. 800-323. Nope. That's our... Oh, boy. I'm getting ready for the fun drive. 800-348-2551. Sorry, Zach, the engineer. Let's go over to Ann in Rhinebeck. Ann.
Hi. Hi, Bray. I have a question for Lou. It's a follow-on question about this putting a price on carbon. So I hear you what you're saying with making it more expensive to, you know, and ultimately raising the price of gas and heating fuel. But you're saying that the money does flow back to the household, so you have income-constrained seniors for whom heating costs are a big issue, and you have lower-income families, and for them to see the price of gas go up and heating oil go up is, like, big-time negative. How are you going to – how do you persuade them that actually they come out ahead of the game paying these higher prices? How does that work economically?
Okay. That's a good question, and it's one that has to be taken very seriously as you design a system. First of all, I've seen a number of studies that indicate that lower-income people actually come out ahead. The greatest energy uses are by the higher income segments of the population, not the lower income segments. The U.S. Treasury Internal Revenue Service Tax Analysis Unit put out a very nice paper in January of 2017. It's working paper 115. And it has analyzed what happens to different groups in the population if you refund what you collect. And the bottom 60 to 70% of income earners do better net on their after-tax income with that kind of a system. Now, implementing it, you still have to have some special safeguards for at-risk portions of the population. But the basic idea of getting it money back to everybody so that they can decide what's best for them seems to work.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ann. We appreciate the call. Our number is 800-348-2551. Lou Alstadt and Matthias Vrie are here to answer your questions. And let's now go to Stephen in Berlin. Stephen.
Hello, hello. So I'm an avid skier, and I am about to be deciding my career path and going to college and such. And I was just wondering, do you guys have any suggestions on something that would help me be able to actually affect climate change in my career path rather than just some job that I'm going to work at and I'm going to get paid? I want to do something that's going to affect the world that I live in, because I want to be able to ski in 10 years and live on this planet, of course.
Matthias.
So you want to change the planet, but you also want to keep skiing. Did I understand that right?
Yeah, I want to find a career path that allows me to affect climate change.
Right. So
what I'm trying to say.
So one option maybe would be to work in some ski resorts and work on their green energy portfolio. There's an increasing number of ski resorts that get their energy from wind power, for example, that are trying to become more environmental friendly. So maybe you could combine the two careers doing something like that.
Lou.
Okay, I think you ought to look at the overall opportunity side of climate change. There are going to be a lot of jobs that didn't exist before that are already starting to grow now. Solar photovoltaic and solar hot water installations, wind turbine installations, heating and cooling system conversions, electric vehicle charging station installations, hydrogen fueling stations and installations, supplying homes and businesses with battery systems, installing home and business energy control systems, recycling solar panels, wind turbines, batteries, smart grid research and development and installation, biofuel research, development and manufacturing, reengineering industrial processes for renewables. There's a lot out there that's positive that will help the economy.
Stephen, thanks for the call. Lou, before we take our next call, I got to ask. You're an oil guy. You were in charge of overseeing oil and gas drilling. What happened? Was it a Scrooge moment where you woke up on Christmas morning? What happened?
Not quite a Scrooge moment. What happened was about 10 years ago, people who live in the Cooperstown area where I live knew I had worked in oil and gas and asked me whether it was going to be safe to have gas wells within 100 feet of Lake Otsego, that's just north of the village. And I said, no, that's crazy. Nobody would do that. And they said, well, it looks like they're trying to. So I started looking into it, and I found out that the way New York State was going to try to regulate fracking was absurd. It had all kinds of holes in it. It was kind of a total giveaway to the oil and gas industry. And I started digging in and researching and talking about what it would take to make it safe, initially thinking that if you put enough regulations on, you would. And that turned into a full-fledged anti-fracking campaign. And as we came to the end of it and finally got the moratorium on fracking, I started thinking about what it really took, and what we were really doing was dealing with greenhouse gases, and that we needed to look at renewable energy. So I've been focusing on renewables since then.
It strikes me that for renewable energy to be this savior or part of the solution, it's got to make money for guys in mobile and all these other companies. Are we at that stage where it's going to be a money-making endeavor?
Renewables,
yeah.
For them? I think they are having a hard time shifting over. It's not the kind of business that they do. Their basic business in the exploration and production side of the industry is extractive. And it's a kind of thing where you go out and find oil and gas and get it out of the ground. And that is getting harder and harder because you obviously go for the easiest to get at first. And all of the conventional oil and gas has pretty much been found and a lot of it developed. So it's getting into much more expensive, difficult areas to operate. The Arctic, very deep water, more than a mile or two deep. Fracking into very dense shale and oil sands. All of those places are expensive, they're risky, and it's going to be hard for them to keep going. Whether The one place that I can see on the positive side is that their offshore expertise in putting wells in water all over the world, deep water and shallow water on continental shelves or beyond, that is very well fitted to installing offshore wind. Where that expertise, the only place it exists is in the service companies and the oil companies that operate in those environments.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. Matthias, you want to add anything there?
No, not really.
Okay, we'll go back to the phones then. And it looks like David in Oneonta has been waiting quite a while. David, you're on.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm the environmental board for the city of Oneonta. And I'm also on Otsego 2000, both of them in Otsego County, where Lou lives. And I want to comment that we are doing something positive here, which anyone in the state of New York can do. We are encouraging that people get an energy audit on their home, their business, their nonprofit, their church. The goal being that you can get a free energy audit and determine where you are losing heat. So this is not necessarily a way of generating heat, but it's a way of saving the energy that we have. There is another agency I just want to mention here is Otsego County Conservation Association has received money from NYSERDA, which we all pay a little bit to on our tax bill, on our energy bill, and that money is being used to encourage people by a kickoff event on the 30, on October 17th here in Oneonta to explain how you can get a free energy audit. Or go to NYSERDA, and I'll give you another quick one, Heat Smart Otsego, www.heatsmartotsego, one word, .org. They can give you information. A second item I'd like to ask is geothermal. This is a way of getting heat without burning, without combusting anything. And I know the people in the state of New York are interested in this. The Public Service Commission last Wednesday held a forum. And at that forum were the folks from NYSERDA, people from National Grid, Con Ed, New York State Energy and Gas, Central Hudson, Con Edison, PS&G Long Island. So all of these energy companies got together probably for the first time. And the conference was about heat pumps,
okay,
which are associated with geothermal. So I'm throwing it out there to see what people can say about heat pumps and geothermal.
All right, guys. Thank you, David.
Okay. First of all, we need to distinguish between deep geothermal, which gets heat from very deep in the earth, usually near volcanoes and things like that. You have it in Iceland. You have it in a few other places. Costa Rica has it. That's not what we're talking about for New York State. We're talking about shallow geothermal, where in order to make heat pumps even more efficient, they're very efficient without this, but to make them even more efficient, if you dig a trench and put coils of pipe in the trench and run fluid through it and bring that back to your heat pump, you're using water that's been heated up just about 8 feet down in the earth to about around 55 degrees instead of trying to displace the heat into 0 degrees, minus 20 degree air. So it's a way to make it more efficient. It is much easier to do on new construction, because otherwise you're going to be tearing up your lawn and doing all kinds of things around your house. Mm. But it certainly works, and it certainly ought to be encouraged.
Matthias, anything? No? All right. Over to the next caller. And this one would be Jody in Valencia. Jody, you're on.
Yeah, my question is, can you talk about the validity of carbon sequestration or carbon farming in relation to dealing with the worst effects of climate change?
Great question, and we'll lead this up to the next break. Thank you, Jody. Carbon sequestration, Matthias.
Okay, so there's different ways of doing this, and the most efficient way is to capture carbon right at the source. So that would basically mean sequester carbon at, for example, coal-fired power plants. So you extract it, you separate it, you compress it, and you inject it underground. That's one way of doing it. The problem with that is it uses energy, so it makes the power plants less efficient, and it makes electricity more expensive. Another option is that you sequester carbon, for example, like Statoil does, which is a Norwegian oil company, where they take the carbon right at the site where they extract the oil from the North Sea. The reason they're doing that is because Norway has a carbon tax, and it's actually cheaper for them to sequester the carbon and inject it on the ground again. So there's an incentive there. Another way, but that's really something that we have not developed to a point where it could be deployed, is to try to actually sequester carbon right out of the air. So basically install big filters where you filter the air and you absorb the carbon with some residue, and you again compress it and inject it underground. The problem right now is that for all of these programs, it's very, very expensive. We're not at the point where we can really use that technology on a large scale.
You may recall that 20 years ago, 10, 15 years ago, the coal industry was talking about clean coal.
Mm-hmm.
This is what they were talking about. It never happened. It's too expensive. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't be doing research on trying to sequester carbon or possibly trap carbon dioxide that's already in the atmosphere, but it's expensive and it's going to take a massive effort.
Based on just what I know of this UN report, anything we do is going to be expensive.
Yes, but some much more than others.
We have to take a quick break here. We're joined today by Matthias Fui and Lou Alstadt, and we talk climate change. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Vox Pop. It's the home stretch. Ray Graff with you. Climate change today on the program. Lou Alstadt and Matthias Vui. And our number is 800-348-2551. We go right back to the phones and Savio and Schoharie.
Hey, thank you very much for a great show. Really worthwhile. And look forward to more of them. A couple of points. One, could the panel please comment on what factors give scientists confidence in the human contributions to global warming? It seems like over the last 20 plus years, we've gained confidence, but it's not clear. It doesn't seem clear exactly what factors. Why are we more confident in the human contributions to global warming? Second is simply on the solution side, on the response side, what are the most cost-effective? Ray's right. We don't have money to fix everything, do everything. What are the most cost-effective solutions, and are there states or countries that are really showing the way so we can say, you know, we're not plowing new ground. There's actually a way to improve our standard of living while we address this.
A lot to unpack there. Okay, thanks a lot. Go ahead, guys.
So I can quickly address the reason why we have become more confident that climate change is mostly man-made. It simply has to do with the fact that the warming is now so large that it has started to emerge outside of the range of variability that we would consider normal. As I mentioned earlier, we have colder years, we have warmer years, and this variability is natural. But now the trend that we've seen in temperature on a global scale has sort of emerged outside of that amplitude. And the other way how we can tell that this is man-made is we can basically play a game where we can look at all the other factors that could be responsible, and one by one we can rule them out. So the most commonly heard is change in the energy we receive from the sun, right? But we can measure that energy that we receive, and it hasn't changed. In fact, it has slightly gone down. So it cannot explain the warming that we've seen. The same is true with other factors such as El Nino or volcanic eruptions, et cetera.
Okay.
Okay. I think that's a great question on making sure that we do the most economical and biggest bang for the buck things as fast as we can. Some of the easy ones there are utility scale wind and solar. They are already cost competitive with new coal plants, with new gas plants for electricity generation. So why wouldn't you do those? There's no real drain on the economy doing that. Texas, big oil state, has more wind power than any place else in the U.S. And they're doing it because it makes money. The other thing is efficiency. Our energy system is horribly inefficient. Lawrence Livermore National Laboratories, which is a government scientific group, used EPA, Department of Energy and Energy Information Agency data to come up with an estimate of U.S. energy consumption. That table shows that 68% of the total energy that we start with is lost. That's two-thirds of what we start with, we don't get any useful work out of. So there's a huge space for working on that. The biggest loser is transportation, where 79% of the energy that goes into our transportation system doesn't do any useful work. That means that like 80% of the gasoline that's in your car, the energy from that doesn't get to the wheels to drive the car. If you switch to an electric vehicle, 80% of what's in the battery gets to the wheels, a huge difference. Mm-hmm. So starting to transit to electric vehicles, maybe hybrid, plug-in hybrid electric vehicles to start with, makes a lot of sense toward moving this forward. And there's not a big cost to doing that.
Back in the 50s and 60s, when there was a brave new world ahead of us, a lot of talk about nuclear energy being the answer. Why did that not turn out to be the case?
I think it's people's concerns over safety. And Fukushima in Japan really set that off. And I think we're not going to see nuclear playing a role in this for a long time to come. It's going to take a lot to get redesigned and tested before you get people's confidence for new. I think there are things I think it's not wise to shut down nuclear plants now that aren't consuming fossil fuels and putting carbon into the atmosphere, but we need to be careful with it.
Matthias, let's go to line number 10 and Al in West Sand Lake. Al.
Hi. Hey, it's glad to see that you guys are doing a climate show.
It's not the first one we've done, but thank you.
Yeah, but I hope there's a lot more in the future.
All right.
It'd be kind of nice if you could put our current climate situation into a historical perspective. When was the last time that we had CO2 levels as high as they are and rising as rapidly? What were the consequences of that?
Okay.
Thanks.
So we have very good records of the CO2 concentration that go back about 800,000 years from ice cores in Antarctica, and the CO2 concentration was never above 300 parts per million. We're now at above 400. So for the last roughly 1 million years, it's certainly unprecedented. We have other, we call these natural archives or proxy data, marine sediments, old soils, that we can look for clues on the CO2 concentration, and we would have to go back more than 2 million years at least to get to a situation where we were even close to the current concentrations.
And why were the conditions 2 million years ago such that the carbon dioxide level was higher?
So I'm not a specialist in the climate conditions at that particular time. I deal more with the last 1,000 years.
Okay.
But it's basically changes in the carbon cycle. So we cycle carbon through the ocean, the atmosphere, and the land, the biomass. And we can have more CO2 in the atmosphere when the oceans, through changing circulation or changing temperature, degas, we call it, they release more gas into the ocean. But, of course, that was a completely different world compared to today. So the constellation, for example, between the Sun and the Earth, the orbital constellation was very different. So we cannot compare that to the
current. What do you mean, the orbital constellation?
So the way that the geometry between the Sun and the Earth changes over time on very slow timescales. For example, our Earth's axis is tilted. That tilt is not always the same. It varies on a timescale. Mm-hmm. Of tens of thousands of years. The way the Earth orbits around the Sun, sometimes that orbit is more elliptical, then it becomes a bit more circular, so at certain times we're a bit further away or a bit closer to the Sun. So these things affect climate, but they do so on timescales of tens and hundreds of thousands of years. So it has nothing to do with the current climate change.
All right, let's go back to the phones. 800-348-2551 is the number. And John in Canaan. John.
Thanks very much. Well, I've got a question that's a little closer to home than the ones that we've been talking about. What is anybody's best guess about what the climate in the Capital District in our sort of radio listening area would look like in 40, 50 years, assuming none of the goals are met?
So that's an interesting question. I actually use a simple slide in my classroom sometimes that's called New York State is on the Move, and it sort of shows what a similar climate would be towards the end of this century if we do nothing. And if we do nothing, Albany, the climate will be more or less what we currently have in Atlanta, Georgia.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Let's keep in mind that it's not just that climate that's going to be different. If that happens, there's going to be parts of the U.S. that are going to be uninhabitable because they'll be underwater. And we will have our own climate refugees within the country. And guess where they're going to come if it's like Albany, Georgia here.
All right, John, thanks for the call. Our number is 800-348-2551. Over to Nick in Albany. Nick.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
Listen, I really appreciate you guys taking the time to make the show here. Love the program. I did want to say I am I'm actually a car salesman, and I sell Nissans. And I am the Leaf, which is an electric vehicle specialist. And I had a customer ask me, what is the point or what is the big advantage of going and switching to an electric vehicle if all of our power is pulled from fossil fuels? And that I made the argument that it's a step in the right direction, and, you know, green energy is on the rise, and, you know, all you can do is try. But it brought up a more broad question, and my question is, what would the utopia of environmentalism, the absolute environmentalism world, look like? Is everybody vegan? Do they all live across the street from where they work? Is the idea of a traveling salesperson or somebody who follows a band like the Grateful Dead all over the country, is that something that you wouldn't be able to do?
All right, we get the idea. All right. Yeah.
I guess I would be afraid of Big Brother telling everybody where they have to live and what they have to eat and things like that. So to me, that's not a utopian world at all.
All right. And going back to his question about, now you touched on this, Lou, about the advantages of electric vehicles. And I know you drive one, and you said efficiency is a big thing.
Yeah. Back to your arguments for your customers, they're only getting about 20% of the energy that's in the tank of gasoline, but they're getting about 80% of the energy that's in the battery for the electric vehicle. So even if you're using the same power plants, you're getting some benefits in efficiency in the transportation side of it. Ideally, what we should be doing is converting our power plants as rapidly as we can to renewable energy, using wind, solar, or anything else that we can do on large scales to replace coal and gas.
All right, Nick, thanks for the call. We go over to our friend Bonnie in Sharon, Connecticut. Bonnie, you're on.
Hi. Basically, what I'm concerned with is that we're working with two different timelines. There is what the planet is going to do, when it's going to do it, and there's three different timelines. There is what the public can do on their own, and then there is the political class and their timeline, and they're even willing to recognize the words climate change as an actuality, depending on which government you're speaking about. That's where the intermesh doesn't happen. Because we end up with those who are in power who, for various reasons, will drag their feet beyond the 2030 deadline where we're looking at 1.5 and 1.5 degrees higher, and we're toast.
Okay. Do you have a question, Bonnie?
Yeah. Basically, my question is, what efforts do citizens, fellow passengers on Spaceship Earth, have to do to cause the political system to pay attention, sort of get woke?
Who wants first?
Okay, I'll give it a try. First of all, there are some groups that are working on this and actually lobbying Congress and putting pressure on, supporting the Climate Caucus in the House of Representatives and things like that. Citizens Climate Lobby is one of them. You can go to citizensclimatelobby.org to get more information. There are others. There's a more conservative group, basically proposing the same programs. Put a fee on carbon, and refund that in some way to the general population. The other thing you can do is vote, and call your representative and tell them that it's important to you. We have to all raise the visibility of climate change as an issue, something that the political class will pay attention to.
All right, Bonnie, thanks so much for the call. You want to weigh in on that?
No, just very briefly. I think the most important thing is to not lose hope. It's very easy to get cynical about this and depressed and tune out, but we can't afford to do that. And it's also important to keep in mind this is not just a U.S. issue. It's a global problem, and many countries are moving forward very, very aggressively. So things are actually happening if you look at it on a global scale.
All right. I guess we have time for maybe one more here, and let's go over to Anthony. He's been waiting longest. Anthony in Albany, you got the last word here, about 30 seconds.
Okay, great. Silly question, kind of. What's the most direct thing I could mention to somebody who does not agree with climate change that would even just make him or her want to go study it?
Matthias.
Tough question, but anyways, please. Thank you.
Yeah, that is a very difficult question because I don't know that person that you're talking to. But for me, I always, if I can't convince somebody with the science, maybe you can convince them with the pocketbook, with economic aspects, or maybe if they have children, you can talk to them more on a moral ground and talk about, you know, maintaining a sustainable future for their kids and grandchildren.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think there's also the idea that if this is a risk, even if an individual can't quite see their way to, quote, believing that it's a risk, what is the downside of taking action? What's the downside of doing something in the right direction? I don't see any.
Well, both of you did a splendid job today. Thanks to Matthias Wee and Lou Alstadt for joining us today, and sorry if you didn't make it through. Thanks for all the great calls today. Support comes from Careers in Transition, LLC, Albany. Dr. Tom Denham, providing individual career guidance, career testing, job strategies, interview preparation, LinkedIn lessons, resume and cover letter writing, Careers in Transition, LLC. Wind Horse Naturopathic Clinic, Brattleboro, Vermont, offering naturopathic medicine, oxidative medicine, colon hydrotherapy, and acupuncture, specializing in Lyme disease, now accepting new primary care patients, windhorsenaturopathic.com. Coldham and Hartman Architects, serving clients throughout New England and New York with architecture designed for resilience and renewability, designed for the next 100 years, cnharchitects.com. And New England Hydroponics, the indoor gardening experts, offering a full selection of hydroponics, organic soils, and indoor gardening equipment, Southampton and Framingham, Massachusetts, online at nehydro.com. Thanks again to Matthias and Lou for joining us today. Thank you for listening. Thanks to our engineer, the great Zach Malloy. Your phones were answered by Jesse King. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, a physical therapist will be here to give us all some physical therapy. Right now, stand by for news.